Hello, ya. I can't hear you.
Thank you very much. Good day, students. We continue this lecture by talking about attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Next time, maybe not tomorrow, but next week, we will talk about autism spectrum disorders. What they have in common is that the diagnosis of these two disorders is made on behavioral symptoms. So there are no biomarkers available. If you have to compare these disorders with, for instance, traumatic brain damage, PKU, hydrocephalus, epilepsy, cerebral palsy, then I can't say that those biomarkers are 100% clear, but science is on its way. Of course, also here, but we are far from saluting the issue. So far, we can say, here we talk about very little insight in the biochemistry behind the disorders, and here it is much more pronounced, and as a result, we have here biomarkers to some degree, and here we haven't. Last time we were talking about PKU as a contrast group. Do you remember? PKU was a metabolic disturbance, and frontostriatal circuits are compromised. It has everything to do with dopamine, and the frontal part of the brain is involved. That's why the executive functions are compromised, like impulse control, planning, etc., etc. In addition to that, there are emotional difficulties, and they are for sure present in many people with PKU, early treated PKU, and they are assumed to be associated with ADHD in autism spectrum disorders. And we were last time also discussing one particular experimental manipulation in a direct comparison between PKU and ADHD. So what is going on with respect to attention deficit hyperactivity disorder? Well, the label started, let's say, around 1900, when a famous child pediatrician Still formulated a deficit which he called minimal brain dysfunction. And he introduced it, but you can, of course, think about a very critical question: what is meant by minimal? At least at those years, it was hardly possible, if possible anyhow, to identify at the brain level disturbances when we talk about what we call nowadays attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. So at a certain moment, there were reasons to change that label from minimal brain dysfunction into hyperkinetic disorder. And hyperkinetic disorder, it shows that for the first time, the label was, let's say, mirroring one of the problems seen in those children, and that is that they are quite physically overactive. At least that is what is suggested. So hyperkinetic disorder. And I think that it is still a label which is used in the United Kingdom. One of the problems showed up in the scientific field. That was that in spite of all kinds of research, those hyperkinetic disorder children were hardly more hyperkinetic than normals. When those children were observed in the classroom, in the play yard, in schools, or in a one-to-one situation in the laboratory, then very few research point into the direction that hyperkinetic children were so-called, were indeed hyperkinetic. So again, there was a change in the label. And that was attention deficit with or without hyperactivity. And nowadays, we have the label attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. It's not a new phenomenon, by the way, that labels are shifting from one way to the other as time proceeds. But now you see how difficult it is to pinpoint precisely, to catch, let's say, the symptomatology in a straightforward way. The diagnosis originally was based on the opinion of parents. So based on questionnaires which were filled in by parents or interviews, it was decided that those children could fulfill the requirements of what we call the nowadays attention deficit hyperactivity. So, in fact, the diagnosis was made by caretakers. And that is, of course, a very subjective way of defining a mental problem. So, in the more recent versions of those manuals who are involved in making a diagnosis, also teachers were involved. And then it appears that many parents and teachers, they disagree about the child. Let's say parents were considering the child to be hyperactive, and teachers had a totally different opinion, or vice versa. So that gave ground to the question, who is right? Which opinion is reliable? It was found out in that research during the 60s that the teacher opinion was very much determined by the IQ level of the children. That means that when the IQ level was lower and also the school achievement was lower in some children, then teachers were more willing to say this child is ADHD in comparison to children with a higher IQ level. The parents, in contrast, they could give a good, reliable description, maybe not when questionnaires were concerned, but at least when they were using diaries. So they were using more words to describe the children. Anyhow, parents and teachers, when they agreed in their opinion, then we talk about pervasive ADHD. And when they disagree, then we talk about situational ADHD. So it depends on the situation. Teachers are judging about the behavior of the children in the classroom and parents at home. So one reason why those two sources of information could disagree has everything to do with the social context. That in one context, it is maybe more easy to identify the problem than in another context. Nowadays, we even have a third situation, and that is that children have to show signs of ADHD in a laboratory condition. So they are observed, one-way screen, or maybe the behavior is videotaped and afterwards rated. And only when parents and teachers, and also then clinicians, consider the child to be ADHD, then the label is given. Now, and here we can read from hyperkinetic disorder to ADHD, and nowadays we talk about an executive function disorder in a sense, that impulse control is at stake, and that brings them close to what I've told you earlier about PKU. There are today a variety of cognitive models, and we will discuss them one by one, and you will learn how difficult it is to make an interpretation when you are using laboratory tests, test scores. So the first is the inhibition hypothesis. It has been put forward by Russ Barkley. He's from the USA. It is a very influential hypothesis, and you can read it in every textbook. Then we have delay aversion. And Edmund Sunuka Bark from the United Kingdom is, let's say, the person who is formulating this problem. And then we have the state regulation deficit. And I must say that that's my cup of tea. So we start with the inhibition hypothesis. Where does it come from? Where is it based on? First of all, Barkley has formulated the inhibition hypothesis, so that children are weak in impulse control. Yeah? They are reacting immediately without thinking. He formulated this inhibition problem in the Psychological Bulletin, volume 121. Here we have the page numbers. Well, this hypothesis, in the first place, is based on paper and pencil tests. We have discussed that concept earlier when we were talking about the difference between laboratory tests and tests used in the clinic. The tests used in the clinic are, let's say, paper and pencil tests. They are easy to establish. And the good news about these tests is that there are norms most of the time, and there are norms available. When you have tested the child, you can see the position of the child in comparison to the norm. But the bad news is, when we talk about research, that the findings are unspecific. We have talked about this issue. What I mean by saying the findings are unspecific, it means that a lot of children with a different diagnosis, so autism or dyslexia, etc., etc., they all may show problems in executing these paper and pencil tests. So we don't learn so much about ADHD in our case. What we learn when we were carrying out this test is the position of the child against the normal population and what type of intervention the child needs. Well, that is a clinical question. When you are interested in research questions, then you need tests who are specific for ADHD or specific for autism. So his hypothesis is partly based on frontal paper and pencil tests, and that is, I would say, not good news. Then another part of the issue is that his hypothesis is based on the so-called stop task. And I will explain to you that in a minute, what is meant by a stop task and what is meant by the findings. And then we have also the point that his hypothesis is based on delayed responding tests. And this is also what I'm going to discuss. So now we talk about the stop tasks. What does it mean? Well, the general situation of the stop task is that a person, a child in this case, is watching a television screen, and on that television screen there is presented either a go signal, you have to respond, or a no-go signal, you don't have to respond. But when it concerns a go signal, then you give the response. And that takes, of course, time, a few hundred milliseconds, as you know now. And then we have a condition where the child is confronted with a no-go signal or a go signal, but now it comes. A few moments later, after the go signal is presented, a stop signal is presented. So it means go, and then immediately stop. This stop signal can be presented just behind the go signal, but it can also be presented just before the offered response is taking place. And you can imagine that when the stop signal is presented here, then it is much easier to stop your intended response than when the stop signal is presented here. Because here in this period, you have the organization of your motor response. We have discussed that when we were talking about cerebral palsy, for instance, with the CNV. Do you remember? So here is motor organization taking place. And at a certain moment, just before the offered response is provided, there is a point of no return. So to make a long story short, when the stop signal is presented close to here, to where you expect a response, then it is difficult to stop your intended response. And the idea is that the more problems children have with response inhibition, impulse control, then more problems they have in this period. And that is indeed what Barclay was finding when he went through all those publications. Yeah, time after time, when the researchers were using the stop task, it was found that in this period, the people with ADHD have a problem with stopping. So Barclay concluded they have a problem with response inhibition. Now I come with a different interpretation. And that interpretation is based on research done by a German group, Konrad et al., 2000, Child Neuropsychology, Volume 6, and here we have the page numbers. And he was testing children, two groups of children, in fact three groups, a control group, a group of children with ADHD, and he was testing a group of children with all kinds of lesions in their brains, here, frontal, temporal, parietal, occipital, etc., etc. And some of them had lesions at the right side, lesions at the left side. And those children were tested about 6 months after their injury. So one again, There were three groups of children: controls, children with ADHD, and children with, I would say, traumatic brain injury. And here you see a complicated index of the willingness, the ability to stop your intended response. And here you see no reward. And here you see reward. And the introduction of the reward in this type of task was quite new. So again, there were two conditions using the stop paradigm. One condition with no reward. So this is, let's say, the old-fashioned stop paradigm. And here, the stop paradigm with an important change. And that change was that when the child was able to successfully inhibit his response, he was rewarded with a marble or with money. So this is a much more motivating condition than what we see here. Let's go to the no reward condition, the old-fashioned stop paradigm. Here we have the controls. They perform much better than the children with traumatic brain injury and the children with ADHD. So they don't, those two groups don't differ in their performance, but you see both groups are showing worse performance expressed here in the ability to stop an intended response. And now we go to the reward condition, that new part of the Conrad et al. Study. And then you see a huge improvement in the performance of the controls. The controls are performing much better when they are rewarded as when they are not rewarded. Well, that is logic. Reward means more motivation, so to speak. So here there is a behavior improvement. Here we see the people with ADHD. Again, I repeat myself, in the non-reward condition, they perform much worse compared to the control group. But when they are rewarded, you see that the performance normalizes. Yeah? And the children with traumatic brain injury, they have problems with this task when they are not rewarded. When they are rewarded, then there's a performance improvement. But you see that the difference in performance remains the same between the control group and the people with traumatic brain injury. So it means that this manipulation can't explain, has nothing to do with the fact that the people with traumatic brain injury have a problem with impulse control. But when it comes to ADHD, you see, when not rewarded, they perform, let's say, in the clinical range. And like Barclay, you should explain these data in terms of people with ADHD have a problem with impulse control. But because of the fact that those researchers implemented a reward condition, you see a totally different picture. When rewarded, performance normalizes. Well, that is, of course, an issue. I mean, when we talk about clumsiness, when we talk about autism, when we talk about Gilles de la Tourette mention it, it is absolutely not the case that in the rewarded conditions the performance of these patient groups normalize. But here it's the case. This study, and it could indicate that it is not stopping which is the problem. It's not lack of impulse control, which is the characteristic of ADHD, but it is whether the children are motivated or not motivated. In conclusion, according to the German study, Konrad et al., stop test findings, inhibition problems in ADHD are secondary to motivation. So returning to this lecture, we started by discussing the inhibition hypothesis of Russ Barkley, and his theory is partly based on paper and pencil tests, and we were very skeptical about the use of these tests. When it comes to research, findings are unspecific. Now we have talked over the stop task findings, and now it seems that the findings are difficult to explain because it's not stopping that might be compromised in ADHD, which is here suggested when it comes to the inhibition hypothesis, but it is motivation. Let's continue with the delayed response test, which is the third layer of the general and accepted inhibition hypothesis in ADHD. Okay, I have to explain to you first the test. And here you see that the test consists out of a number of trials, not seven, but let's say 100. And what you here see is the time in seconds after a stimulus. So the child is watching to a television. And then there is a letter presented for 1 second, for 2 seconds, 3 seconds, four, five, six, seven, eight, maybe up to 9 seconds. I don't know. It doesn't matter. And the child is instructed to wait with his responses. And the child is then, of course, asking, how long do I have to wait? And then you say to the child, I'm not telling you. I'm not going to tell that to you. You have to find it out yourself. In fact, the program of the test is made as such that, let's say, after 5.5 seconds, yeah, when you wait more, longer, then you are rewarded. So again, a stimulus is presented. The child is waiting. He doesn't know that he has to wait at least 5.5 seconds. And when he is responding after 5.5 seconds, then he is rewarded. So the child doesn't know it. So in trial number one, sure, the child is, let's say, reacting after 2 seconds. Then second trial, the child is waiting, for instance, about 3.5 seconds. It's all trial and error. Sometimes the child is reacting a little bit faster than here. There is no reward. And here he comes close to the reward. And the child doesn't know this. And then on a certain moment, the child is waiting long enough and is rewarded. And then maybe from there on, he remains starting to react in this area. Maybe he goes a little bit back now and then, but I think that the picture is clear. The control children, they try to find out on the basis of trial and error how long to wait, and at a certain moment they do that. This is the profile of a child with ADHD. Again, a go signal, the child is waiting, is not rewarded. And I made it, of course, a little bit exaggerated. I'm exaggerating here, but to make it clear to you, the child will never be rewarded. He is choosing for a short delay between the presentation rate and the response. Yeah? And on the basis of these types of findings, Russ Barkley claimed that people with ADHD are difficult to wait. They immediately react. Yeah? They have no impulse control. That is, let's say, his interpretation. But let us go now to another interpretation. So here we are talking about the performance of a control child. And suppose that we have no 7 trials, but 100 trials. Then you can ask yourself the question, how long is the task duration? Well, to keep it simple, you can say, well, 2 seconds, here 3, here 2.5, here 4, etc., etc. And if you sum it up, then the task duration produced by the fact that you are waiting is much more pronounced than in the child with ADHD. Because due to the fact that he is performing here so quick, he has maybe a task duration. He is, in fact, producing a task duration of a few minutes. And that you could also, let's say, interpret in terms of these findings, in terms of motivation. The control child is motivated to wait, to get some reward when you are waiting. And the person with ADHD, they hate to be tested. They want to get out of the laboratory as quick as possible. So they generate very fast responses. And they are not rewarded, but what does it matter? If they have to choose between having a reward, but as a price you have to pay, the task duration is longer, the people with ADHD choose for quick responses. And then they don't give a mind about reward. Well, that is the hypothesis which has been put forward by Russ, not Russ Barkley, Edmund Sonuka-Bach. Because here you can read, and that is what is shown by Sonuka-Bach, a person from England, that if the ADHD child is unable to manipulate the time on task, then he will act like this. But when he is able to manipulate it, then the responses will be given here, So how can you manipulate the time on task? Well, when you respond here 2 seconds, and immediately there is here a signal again, and you respond, and then immediately there is another signal, then you have in your hands the task duration. When that is not the case, then people with ADHD, they have about the same ability to wait, to earn money. And this is the delay aversion theory, which has been put forward by Sonuka Bark. And it was formulated in the Journal of Cell Psychology and Psychiatry, volume 33. And now he continues, of course, writing papers. So the child with ADHD does not like to wait, even in conditions of reward. So here we go again. This is the profile when a child can determine the time on task, and then he doesn't matter whether he's not rewarded. But when he can't manipulate the time on task, then he will be rewarded, because then he's also showing down his responses. So now going back to the structure of this lecture, we started to talk about cognitive models. We started with the inhibition hypothesis of Russ Barkley. There were three issues to discuss. And there is not so much real scientific evidence in favor of the fact that people with ADHD have a real inhibition problem. It depends. And then we have Edmund Sonuka Bark, and he formulated the delay aversion, and we have just discussed that. Now it's getting time to talk about my model, and that is called the state regulation in ADHD. And here you find some reviews if you are interested in writing a paper about these issues. What is meant by what is meant by state regulation? Well, here you read the word performance. Well, it can be everything. It could even be driving a car. And maybe for the sake of simplicity, why not using that as a starter? So here you have a, let's say, the way you drive a car with little variation, it is good. And it is simply good because you are in an optimal state. You are alert. But then at a certain moment, you feel that your optimal state, let's say, a physiological state, starts to become less optimal. You start to daydreaming, maybe you start to sleep halfway. And then two things can happen. You have a performance decrement, and here you stop the car. But when you have reasons to continue driving, you try to do your best to fight against this drop in performance. How do you do that? Well, you could start by opening the window some stimulation. That's what you need. You can also start to open the radio. You can start to sing a song. You know it yourself. You know what I mean when I say here you perform in an optimal shape, and then at a certain moment, after half an hour, after an hour, you feel that you drop, that there is a performance drop. And if you want to continue, then you have to fight. And this difference between fighting against a performance drop, that is what we could call motivation. So it means that a non-optimal state is heroding, and you are fighting against it to keep the performance efficiency at a stable level and to remain in a so-called optimal state. Okay, let's have a break and then we continue. So the break is 7 minutes or something, okay? Manipulate this phenomenon of being in an optimal state. Your performance is fast, adequate, little, no errors, little or no variance. And then you have to fight against a drop in performance. Well, in our laboratory, we at a certain moment found a very essential manipulation. And that is the signal rate. So the presentation rate of stimuli on which you have to react or not is manipulated. Here you can read the fast presentation rate, the fast event rate of stimuli, and here a slow presentation rate. So here, presentation rate is every 1.5 second you see a new stimulus and you have to react, and here every 6 or every 8 seconds. Let's start with the people with PKU. When the presentation rate is slow, they are making a lot of errors. And when the presentation rate is fast, they also make a lot of errors. So the presentation rate is not influencing their performance efficiency. And we already have discussed this when we were talking about PKU. That is, they are fast but impulsive responders. So in the fast event rate, they are producing a lot of errors, and also in the slow event rate. And here we have the people with ADHD. When the presentation rate is fast, they make a certain amount of errors, which is almost comparable to the control group. But when the same task has to be carried out with the same task duration and the same amount of go stimuli and no go stimuli, you see that in the slow event rate, they are making a lot of errors. So you see here that a fast presentation rate puts those people with ADHD in a so-called optimal state. They need stimulation. And when the stimulation is, well, absent because of the slow presentation rate of stimuli, they start to produce a lot of errors. And here we have the controls. There is a little bit an increase here in the slow event rate, but it is about the same. So those controls, they are fighting here in keeping the performance efficiency at a certain level. And the people with ADHD are not able to do that. So returning to this picture again, the people with ADHD, they show a drop in performance. They are not fighting. And the people with the control children, they are trying to remain in an optimal state by becoming more and more motivated. This is a study which has been carried out by one of my former PhD students, Metin. And he was carrying out a meta-analysis of all kinds of studies where the researchers were using, by accident, by the way, different event rates. So in certain studies, the event rate was quite fast. And all the researchers, without thinking it over, they used a much more slower presentation rate of stimuli. And when you put that in a meta-analysis, then Metin, he found out that you can see there is a correlation, especially in the people with ADHD. That is to say, the slower the event rate is, the more inefficient becomes their performance. So this is, of course, quite a strong evidence in favor of the idea that event rate is a key in ADHD. It is strong because many different type of research has been put together in different laboratories, defining in a different way their ADHD subjects, and they found a correlation. The slower the event rate, the more errors they make. And here we have the direct comparison between ADHD and PKU. Again, that in the people with ADHD, you see that, especially in a slow event rate, they become slower. And here the errors, that the PKU people are making a lot of errors because they are reacting so fast. And in the ADHD, it depends. And this is also what we already have discussed, that real impulsivity means you see a stimulus. Here you have a buildup of evidence, and the people with PKU don't wait. They simply react. And the people with ADHD, they are simply getting slower and slower, and the performance becomes more and more variable, and they are making more and more errors. So those two groups of people are totally different, PKU and people with ADHD. Now we are arrived at the issue of what really happens with respect to the psychophysiology when people with ADHD here show the performance decrement in the slow event rate, and the people who are the controls, that they are fighting to remain their performance efficiency at an optimal level. And we have defined this in terms of motivation, and we used three different physiological indices in our research. Heart rate variability, I will explain that later to you. The P300 amplitude, we have discussed this, and fMRI, we also have discussed this as far as the tool is concerned. Do you remember? It was one of our first meetings that I started to talk about this type of methodology. So again, the controls are fighting, and that leads to physiological costs. The more you fight, the more costs you have to pay. This is the heart rate variability. And it goes from 0 to 49.50. So you must imagine that when we talk about the heart rate, we have the beat to beat interval, boom, 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 and we have the variability. And there are all kinds of different variabilities in the heart rate. There are very slow rhythms, and there are very fast rhythms. The fast rhythms of the heartbeat, they are concerned with respiration, with talking and things like that. The slow rhythmical changes are due to keeping the temperature, for instance, at a stable level. But here, especially when we talk about the rhythm of the tent, this peak may reflect motivation. That is, the more motivated you are, the slower this amplitude is. So, for instance, when you have an experiment, you and I, and we all have to carry out a calculation task, and we are not rewarded, then this peak of the heart rate variability is much more pronounced in comparison to the condition that you are motivated because of, for instance, the introduction of reward. There are many different types of research showing that there is a relation between the heart rate variability and things like physiological costs in order to remain in an optimal shape. And here we have the findings with respect to the heart rate variability test using a fast event rate and a slow event rate. And again, here we have the amplitude of that particular part of the heart rate spectrum. And the rule of thumb was, the more pronounced the amplitude is, the less motivated. So here in the fast event rate, there is a difference between the controls and the people with ADHD. But in the slow condition, this difference is more pronounced. So using the heart rate variability measure, it seems that people with ADHD, that they don't allocate enough energy, motivation to realize an optimal task performance because of the fact that the amplitude is much more pronounced in this group. Okay. Here we have the event-related potentials. We already have talked this over this tool. It has an excellent temporal resolution, and it gives insight in the energetical mechanisms, so the mechanisms of being motivated. You have already seen this picture. Yeah, so here we have the presentation of the stimulus. The first few, the first 50 milliseconds are for psychologists not of interest, but what happens here with those peaks and especially the P300, that makes sense because here the P300 decision-making is taking place. And there is research suggesting that the more pronounced the peak is, the more motivated the people are, the more energy they are allocated to the task in order to keep the performance efficiency at a stable level. Now, here we have, again, the fast presentation rate, and here the slow presentation rate of those go, no go tasks. Eh? And here you see the electrical reaction. Here we have a beautiful P300. And we see that there is no difference between the controls and the ADHD children as far as the P300 is concerned during the fast presentation rate. Here we have the slow presentation rate. So the same task, but here the presentation rate is slow. And here you can see the purple line of the people with ADHD that the P300 is less pronounced as in the controls. It is, of course, very little, but it is statistically significant. And this is, let's say, the space we have. It concerns only tenth of milliseconds differences and very small differences in amplitude, but it's significant. So not only when we use the heart rate, but also the P300 as an index of motivation, allocating extra energy to the task, then you see that this is a second proof that people with ADHD are not spending too much effort in their task. And here we have the MRI. So the MRI, as I have told you, as such, is giving information about the activation of certain brain systems. And you can see here those red spots, which means differences in activation rate between controls and people with ADHD. And here you can see the fast event rate. And here it was asked, give me the areas where the controls, the brains of the controls are more activated than the brains of the people with ADHD during the fast condition. And then you see that there are more spots which are active in the brain in comparison to the question, give me the areas of the brains where the people with ADHD are, showing more activity in the brain during the fast condition, and then you see that there are no spots. So fast, and the controls are more activated as far as the brain activation is concerned than in the people with ADHD. Here we have the slow condition. And here we ask ourselves the question, give us the areas in the brains where the brains of the controls are more activated than in the people with ADHD. And then you see a lot is happening here. Also, when you have to compare this activity with this activity. So in the slow condition, the people with ADHD are allocating more activation to the task than the people with ADHD. And in the slow condition, give me the brain areas where the ADHD people are more activated than in the controls, then nothing happens. So overall, we have fast, slow. Then here is, let's say, the message. The brains of the controls are very activated in the slow condition to fight against the decrement of task performance. So we have, in that sense, discussed three different physiological variables, and they all show, let's say, the same direction. Less motivated are the people with ADHD. And here we can ask the question, which part in the brain is actually less activated, less aroused? Well, here we have the frontal part. Here we have the spinal cord. And here we have those dopamine factors we have discussed earlier. And the energy goes, the dopamine, which is energy, goes here from the spinal cord and here at the thalamus. The activation goes to different areas and among others also to the frontal part. And it seems that especially this part of the brain in people with ADHD is compromised. It is less active. In conclusion, according to the state regulation theory, ADHD is a motivation deficit related to an insufficient energy allocation. And then is the state regulation deficit the same as this delay aversion? Let's go back to, let's say, this picture. Here, these were performance data, fast event rate, slow event rate. Fast event rate, the controls are making a certain amount of errors. The controls are fighting, and they are successful because there is a little bit increase in the performance deficiency, but you see it is about the same. But in people with ADHD, it goes errors to 20% to about 50%. And we have discussed those three indices, that they are allocating less effort, less energy to fulfill the task requirements due to a boring, slow event rate task. In my discussions with Edmund Sulukabark, who I have discussed earlier with his delay aversion theory, he was always saying, that's my name. But in the slow event rate, we know that people with ADHD don't like to wait. And that is what they have to do here, because here the delay is 1 second, and here it is every 8 seconds. So my interpretation of a state regulation deficit is different than Edmund Sonnenberg's hypothesis that here they can't delay. They can't stay delayed. They don't like it. So we met in the University of Ghent, Edmund and I, and we both were visiting professors. And we were saying, yeah, what is now the essential difference between your theory and mine? And how can we set up an experiment that could differentiate between delay aversion, the inability to wait, against a state regulation deficit, that is, that people with ADHD don't regulate their state, that they are not allocating enough energy to remain in a so-called optimal state. And what we agreed upon was that when we have an experiment where we introduce methylphenidate, which is an energizer, it focuses on dopamine, I have explained it to you earlier, then according to the delay aversion theory, methylphenidate has only one direction, namely, it should dampen the symptoms. But according to the state regulation theory, methylphenidate could increase the symptoms when subjects are in an overactivated state. So let's see what I mean by that. So here you have the activation. Here we have an optimal activation. And here we have underactivation. And here we have overactivation. So according to the state regulation theory, this inverted U-shape curve in ADHD is too narrow. They are easily underactivated, so they are easily bored, but they might also be easily overactivated. And that level of overactivation might be achieved when you combine these two energizers. Event rate, we have talked this over. When there is a fast event rate, then in people with ADHD, they become better. But when you have event rates crossed with methylphenidate, is it so that the people with ADHD are easily in an overactivated state? Well, that is, I would say, the type of experiment Edmund and I, we agreed upon. Event rate and methylphenidate, they both are acting on dopamine, and let's see what the outcome of this study showed us. Here, children with ADHD on medication or off medication, and the medication was methylphenidate. The good news about methylphenidate is that you can easily put people on medication and also off medication without withdrawal effects. You can't say that with respect to other compounds, with respect to other drugs. And in this study, we asked the factory to have placebo and a real Mathilde Fanny date, which looks the same, which tastes the same. So the people with ADHD, they really didn't know when they were on medication or off medication. You have to swallow that medication, let's say every about 45 minutes before the experiment takes place. And this is what really happened. So people were on medication in some occasions, and the same people with ADHD were sometimes off medication. So here we have methylphenidate, and here we have placebo. So here we have the slow event rate, and here the fast event rate. Let's see what happens with the slow event rate when people with ADHD are off medication, on placebo. Well, we all have this discussed this over and over. They will produce a lot of errors. And when the same people are on medication, then you see that the amount of errors is decreasing, the performance becomes much better. So in a slow event rate, where there is a lack of dopamine, when you give them a drug which is acting on dopamine, the performance becomes better. But now the fast event rate. When people are on placebo, we know that the amount of errors is decreasing because also event rate is acting on dopamine. With the fast event rate, more release of dopamine takes place. So if you compare this to here, then it is the old finding that people with ADHD have benefit when there is a fast event rate. But when you combine those two energizers, so a fast event rate with methylphenidate, then you see that those people with ADHD are making a lot of errors. And this is exactly the U-shaped curve that two energizers focused on dopamine is too much for the people with ADHD. They are not able to dampen the system. So when we talk about a slow event rate, they are unable to lift the system. And when it comes to too fast, then they can't dampen it when they are also then on medication. And this finding is in favor of the state regulation deficit in ADHD, that methylphenidate has no one direction. It improves performance in conditions where there is a lack of dopamine, but when there is a fast event rate, then which leads to a release of dopamine, then methylphenidate is leading to a lot of errors. With noise, we in fact found the same. I was not involved in that research, which makes it maybe even stronger. So once again, we have an underactivated stage and event rate, fast event rate will lift it. And we have an overactivated stage, which means that people with ADHD can't inhibit that stage. And here we have manipulated fast event rate together with noise, because noise is also a manipulandum to increase the amount of dopamine. And here you find the results of that study. Now I have to look especially in people who are super attentive, so these were students, then you see that when there is little noise, the performance is okay. And when the noise increases, you see that in the controls, in the superintendive, you see that there is a performance decrement. In the people who are sub-attentive, you see again, they increase, and it is much more like this. Again, that inverted U-shape. So noise and the fast defend rate, it is in fact so that people with ADHD, they like stimulation. So stimulation in turn is increasing the dopamine release and they have the benefit out of it. But when it is too much, then they have problems in slowing the state down. So we were talking about a variety of cognitive models. And we see that the inhibition hypothesis, well, there is very little in favor of that. The delay aversion theory has been tested in a so-called one-to-one study between delay aversion and state regulation. And Edmund and I, we both agreed that so far the evidence is in favor of the state regulation deficit. Well, this is a good example for a paper, I would say, that you are discussing, maybe not with respect to ADHD, but then with respect to another mental problem, and you compare different theories, and well, let's see where it brings you when it comes to drawing conclusions. So we were talking about the state of underactivation, the state of overactivation, but here again, underactivation and sensation seeking. That is an old concept in the field of ADHD, and this is the last, slide I would like to discuss with you. That here we had a fixed interval. So children were watching to a television screen, and this was the time that a stimulus was presented on the screen. And here not, and here a new stimulus. And there away, and then here a new stimulus. It is fixed because the interstimulus interval is the same. And here we have an irregular interval, which means that you can't predict when the next stimulus is shown on the screen. What was the finding with respect to very secure behavioral observations we made? We were observing the looking away from the screen. So what happens was that children with ADHD, they were looking away from the screen, let's say here. And here they started to look back to the screen because a new stimulus shows up. And here they look away and here they look back. And due to the fact that they were able to look away from the screen, it is a little bit like self-stimulation via external means. And you get a little bit new stimuli and it helps. The performance here is much better in comparison to what happens when children with ADHD are performing this task here because here they were looking away from the screen and then they missed the trial. So the need to look away from the screen is the same between these two conditions, but here the people with ADHD could manage to look away and to look back, because they could predict it. Whereas here, there is, yeah, they missed the stimulus. And here, also because looking away and looking back, it takes time. And when you don't know how to prepare yourself when a new stimulus shows up, it means that that the price to pay is that it will lead to a drop in task efficiency. So one of the symptoms of people with ADHD is when we go back to this issue. That here, they are not able to remain in an optimal stage. Here, because of the fact that they get stimulation, a fast presentation rate of stimuli, or noise, yeah, or methylphenidate, it helps them. So they need stimulation. And when the stimulation is lacking, then it leads to a performance decrement. Now, the problem is that when you are starting to work in practice, and when you are dealing with parents with ADHD, then you could say, well, ADHD, in fact, is a motivational deficit. Well, I would say, if you put it in that way, then you harm children. Because the layman, parents are, in that sense, not experts, they think that motivation means that you have a, let's say, a button here somewhere, and when you push on it, everything goes better. And you simply have to push. And it could be that when you say it is a motivation deficit, that the caretakers are saying, yes, that makes me so angry. Because when that person, my child, is, let's say, involved in a task he is interested in, then he performs much better. And that could be, of course, becoming irritating in caretakers. And this is, of course, also what could happen between in the relation between parents and children with ADHD. But as soon as you start to understand and also to try to explain that motivation is a skill, like talking, like running, like writing, et cetera, et cetera. And that, you need a very complicated nervous system with all kinds of characteristics to become and to remain motivated. And that it is indeed a skill when you can also remain motivated when the task conditions are boring. So in practice, it is not out of the question that children with ADHD, they adore maybe gymnastics and are not so willing to follow lessons of calculation and things like that. But then you have to understand it in terms of, yeah, they are easily bored. They are also easily overactivated. So their nervous system is not well equipped to deal with boredom. Now, next time, that is tomorrow, we continue with this issue and we try to resolve, partly, of course, the issue of what happens when we introduce the word monitoring disability. And so, self-monitoring, we already were discussing about this issue, the skill to be aware of your performance during task execution. And it could be the case that people with ADHD have a deficit in monitoring themselves. Now, I hope to see you back tomorrow 2:15. Bye-bye.